Should voters get to decide on money for schools? Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, the sorry state of some local school buildings. We'll look at a Times Union investigation and take your calls. It's 549-2937. Then later, he's the creator of one of the top toys of the 80s. In today's First Coast Success, find out how a local CEO is bringing back pound puppies. Remember those? All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, broken AC, crumbling buildings, and a big backlog of deferred maintenance. A new report in the Florida Times Union says public school buildings across Duval County are in bad shape. Now, the story runs this morning just as the school board is holding a news conference this morning as well, urging city council to let voters decide on a half-cent sales tax for school repairs. Emily Block, education reporter for the Times Union, is here now with more. Emily, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. Do you support or oppose a half-cent sales tax to fix up all of the school buildings around town that are, in some cases, falling apart? Broken AC, crumbling walls and floors, lots of issues with these physical buildings. We want your calls. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at wjct.org and tweets to at Melissa Injax. Our Facebook page is open as well. Okay. Lengthy report in the paper today looking at a whole range of issues. What are some of the biggest maintenance woes you found, Emily, in Duval County Public Schools?
Sure. So actually, this story came out yesterday. It was yesterday's centerpiece story, but it was a long
Not
one.
Not today.
Correct. Yeah. But so I looked into a year's worth of internal air conditioning reports, work orders that regarded air conditioning work in Duval schools. And what we found out was that it came to about over $9 million of work in 1 year of internal air or internal and external air conditioning work.
So it cost the district $9 million a year to patch up old and faulty AC.
Yes, correct.
You also interviewed a local mother who routinely runs through a Chick-fil-A drive-thru with iced tea and lemonade and takes it over to her child's school because the AC goes out so often.
I did. So when I started at the Times Union a couple months ago, every time I was at a city council meeting, a school board meeting, a workshop meeting, a community meeting, there was at least one parent talking about the AC being out at their child's school. So I met some of these mothers and I spoke to them. And one, Stacey McDonald Taylor, told me that she has the Chick-fil-A app on her phone and she has an AC outage order saved automatically to her phone because it happens so often.
So this is an example of what the district is dealing with and why they're asking for this half-cent sales tax. What are some of the issues that you found besides AC not working properly?
Exactly. So AC is just a piece of it. That's $9 million worth. But something that Superintendent Green explained was that that's just part of it. We're looking at crumbling infrastructures, at pipes that are corroding, at stairwells that are falling apart, at structures that are caving in. I mean, if you look at the story that we ran, there's a picture with this wooden scaffolding that has to hold the structure up. And this poor classroom has their like posters and things just strung on top of that wood scaffolding.
How is the district dealing with these issues right now with the money that they have to work with?
Currently, they're $243 million in deferred maintenance. They're in the whole $243 million for repairs and maintenance, and it's costing them about $500,000 a month. So they're dealing with them as they can come. And because of that problem or projects that were wishlisted, essentially, schools that wanted a new carpet or were supposed to get a new carpet in the next year because another school had a flood, the other things had to get pushed down the queue because other things just had to be dealt with more immediately.
How are these physical plan issues affecting the learning environment for students and impacting teachers' ability to teach? What are educators and students saying to you?
I mean, obviously, they're upset about it. I spoke to a principal at Frank H. Peterson Academies of Technology, their vocational school that gets students ready for the workforce. And they say that air conditioning issues happen at least once every week. They had to move their students around and shuffle them, so they're getting less hands-on work because of that. They have to do textbook work because they're in a different room than they would usually be in.
Okay. With all of this said, members of the Duval County School Board, along with some other groups, are holding a news conference this morning asking the Jacksonville City Council to put this on the ballot this fall so that the voters can vote up or down a half-cent sales tax for schools. The City Council is meeting the full council tomorrow night, and they may or may not approve this idea. They may kick it to 2020.
Correct.
When you've interviewed members of the City Council about this, where are they on this issue?
So members of the City Council, it's a little bit of half and half. They see the immediacy. They see why members want it for 2019, but they also worry about the cost of having a special election and say that maybe general election of 2020 might make more sense fiscally. School board members are arguing against that, of course. They're saying that they need it to happen now because we're already so many millions of dollars in the hole that the longer they wait, the more things are going to queue up.
Okay. You've also interviewed representatives of the charter school industry and movement who have asked for proportional funding for charter schools in Duval County. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes. So members of the Civic Council and people with charter school interests have asked that they get worked into this plan, that they get worked into the referendum. And Duval School Board hasn't spoken against that yet. They've said that they are willing to have a meeting about it and talk about it. And that's where it stands currently.
Okay. And we reported last week a recent UNF Public Opinion Research Lab poll showed about 75% of registered voters in Duval County support a half-cent sales tax to upgrade or replace aging schools. However, a minority supports a special election this year. About 49% say they're fine with this going on the ballot next year in 2020.
Correct. Moms are saying that they want the chance to vote. Overwhelmingly, the moms and teachers and faculty members that I've spoken to want say that more than anything, they just want to be able to vote. And that's what the poll is reflecting as well.
Let's talk about how Duval County differs in terms of the politics of this from other counties as well, Emily. As you report, throughout the state, 24 different counties have implemented a half-cent sales tax for schools. In St. John's County, voters approved a school-related tax by a margin of 60%. That was a few years ago.
Correct.
And this week on Thursday, Clay County School Board will decide if it wants to put a half-cent sales tax increase on a special election ballot, a similar measure. These other counties have not been forced to jump through the additional hoop of asking City Council to approve this. Duval stands alone so far, in recent memory anyway, when it comes to how this is working its way through the political process.
Correct. My colleague David Bauerlein actually said that, reported that it's a first of its kind legal opinion, that this is unprecedented in other counties.
And this is a legal opinion issued by the city's Office of General Counsel.
Correct.
Let's talk about that for a minute, and then we'll go to quite a few calls that we have for you.
Sure.
Okay. This opinion stated that before the school board can put this on the ballot, they must first go to the City Council for approval. And the rationale for that legal opinion is?
It's the way that they're interpreting the law. So they're saying that it shall go before City Council ahead of time. And that's where things get murky, is what does shall mean? So every other county so far has interpreted shall to mean it must. Whereas in Duval, it's looking like shall might mean maybe.
Okay, let's go to some calls now as we talk about Duval County's school buildings. A new report in the Florida Times Union looks at the broken AC and a host of other maintenance issues in schools all over the community. Where do you stand on this? What are your questions? It's 549-2937. Richard is on the north side. Hi, Richard. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can barely hear you, Richard.
Okay, I'm sorry. Let me do some. Okay, I have a problem.
Talk right into your phone there, Richard.
Okay.
Oh, that's better.
That's better.
Okay. I have a problem with the idea that we don't have any funds available. I was under the impression that the lotto program, it only gives money to the Bright Futures program.
That's mostly true. Yeah. Yeah. For the most part. Yeah.
But that's wrong. This makes billions and billions of dollars to the state that's supposed to go to education, not one specific educational program, but it should go to all.
Okay, thanks, Richard. I appreciate the call. And often when we talk about education funding on this show, Emily, we get at least one call like that saying, isn't the lottery money supposed to fund these types of improvements? But the reality is, as Richard said, it mainly goes toward prizes and scholarships, the lottery funding.
It's a common misconception because Florida lottery money is indeed coming in and it is funding scholarships and a few other things, but there's only so much money to go around between all the schools within the state.
549-2937. Tom is on the west side. Hi, Tom.
Ah, good morning. I just wanted to say that, I think a better solution to this would still be a millage increase or an impact fee. I think these things would be better solutions, but looking at what the city council is doing so far in this, I support the half-cent sales tax, and I hope the city council will get out of the way of this so that it can happen as soon as possible. We're holding up our children's futures, and that's just unconscionable.
Thanks, Tom. And let's explain why impact fees and millage increases aren't a political solution for this. They're
Absolutely.
Not a viable option for this local school board.
Sure.
Emily.
So impact fees would only touch a portion of what Duval County schools are saying that they need. It would only be able to be used in high growth areas. So only a few schools would be able to benefit from it.
And let's talk about millage.
Sure. So it's kind of a similar issue where it would only impact a piece of the pie.
There, and it, correct me if I'm wrong, but the legislature forestalls some of, as the editorial in your newspaper, the Times Union, writes, the legislature has limited the ability of school districts to fundraise in these through these avenues.
Correct. As far as property taxes, it wouldn't even be an option for the school district. The legislature does not offer that.
Okay. And so, you know, this report, by the way, is exhaustive. You spent weeks working on this.
I did.
And what one discovers when you read through it is the issues are widespread across the county. They're sort of sprinkled all over the county.
Yes.
But especially in the older buildings, because Duval County has the oldest public school buildings in the state of Florida. Many are over 50 years old. Some are close to 100 years old.
Absolutely.
Like Stanton, for example, is one that comes to mind. And so these older buildings need maintenance and lots of calls. Meanwhile, it's 549-2937. Andy is downtown. Hi, Andy. Good morning.
Yeah, I was just wondering where the priority for this was under the previous school superintendent. Nothing was mentioned 5 years ago, 3 years ago, 48 months ago.
You know what, though, Andy? That's actually not true. The previous superintendent, Nicolai Vitti, he brought it up on this program more than once. He did.
Okay.
Although he left before he could do anything about it or do what the current superintendent is doing.
What's the problem with holding this election, which actually shouldn't be a problem, but what's the problem with holding this during a general election when everyone will turn out instead of holding a special election where only those interested in the issue would turn out?
So that's the question.
And how much money does the Federal Department of Education provide to the school board? I believe right now that's about zero, and nobody's covered why that's the case. So could you shed a little light on that as well?
Sure. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. So that's a question that has actually been raised a few times. It's kind of why this has become such a hot topic in the last few months. School board members want to see it happen immediately. They want a 2019 special election. City council and other political figures are arguing that it should wait and be held off into a 2020 general election for a larger turnout and for less special election costs. The school board is saying they don't have time to wait, that they're racking up these costs, that their $240 million in deferred payments are ready, that it's costing $500,000 in maintenance per month, and that the longer we apply these Band-Aids, that it's just going to spend more money.
Here's a comment on our First Coast Connect Facebook page from Mark. When the school board can explain how the schools were allowed to fall into a state of disrepair, when they explain where the monies budgeted over the years for maintenance were spent, when they can explain their lack of foresight to plan for growth and expansion, when they can provide explanation for their ineptness and incompetence, then and only then should any kind of expansion of funding be addressed. What about that point of view? Essentially blaming the school board for the state of affairs that Duval is now in.
So an interesting part about this report is we're looking at a year's worth of maintenance, air conditioning maintenance, and we're only looking at the internal orders. Like, yes, it cost $9 million in total, but we only had access to internal work orders, which were only about $3 million. The rest was outsourced work, and that's only 12 months worth of data. So it looks like, I mean, I think with 9,000 work orders just internally, it's fair to interpret that they're piecing together what they can and trying to fix things as they happen. But it's a matter of how much money they even have if we're already deferred.
So the so you're saying then that the perception among some voters and constituents out there that the school board has mismanaged money is inaccurate?
I'm saying that there are different superintendents. Diana Green has only been in the seat for 10 months. And in those 10 months, she's been dealing with about 9,000 work orders just on air conditioners alone. So it looks like they're taking it as they can.
This has been going on for a while. Here's an email from Shannon. I have clear memories of being a freshman at Mandarin High in the year 2006. A class I was taking had to be held in the hallway because the class wasn't safe for us to be in for some reason. And this was over 10 years ago. Okay, so this is not a new issue.
No.
As any homeowner knows, at a certain point, deferred maintenance issues come to a head.
Absolutely.
And that's where Duval is. St. Johns County addressed it 4 years ago when its voters decided to tax themselves to pay for these types of upgrades. Clay County is looking to do the same thing. At a certain point with older buildings, deferred maintenance just becomes an overwhelming problem, and this is what is going on. And so, you know, some of the school board members held a news conference this morning,
yes,
trying to lobby the city council, in effect, Emily, to let the voters decide this sooner rather than later. How effective or not do you think that type of tactic will be?
I mean, just at the public hearing about this issue, there were 63 or 68 people. I can't remember off the top of my head, but somewhere in the 60s that had comment cards that wanted to speak out about the issue. I think the city council knows, and the more they hear about it, they know that this is a problem. It's just a matter of what's the most tactful way to address it.
Casey tweets the show, the need is clear and the support is clear. The only thing that's unclear is why the city council would want to take on the blame for dilapidated schools after having this thrown in their laps by a dicey legal analysis rather than let the constituents decide. Is this something that some of the city council members have expressed that sort of frustration, that they feel this has been thrust upon them rather than having this executed by other elected officials, the school board?
Right, of course. Well, again, like we've said, that this is an unprecedented way to deal with this. It's not happened before, so it's uncharted territory.
549-2937, Doran is on the west side. Doran, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Listen, I'm intrigued by this because your guest has said $500,000, I think, per month in maintenance. Well, how much money would the referendum cost? I mean, we talk about thousands of dollars or millions of dollars or tens of millions, because it's pretty easy to do the cost-benefit analysis. If you're spending $500,000 per month, and let's say it costs a few hundred thousand dollars to do the referendum, you need to do the referendum and save the money.
That's,
you know,
what,
just do the math.
Right. That's what school board members are saying as well.
And this would raise, correct me if I'm wrong, $80 million over 15 years.
Yes,
is that right?
That's correct.
And then it would sunset.
Yes.
Okay, so this would cost the average household $6 a month, according to school board estimates.
Yes.
Okay. What about the argument that a sales tax is a regressive tax, that it, even though it's a small amount of money, it affects poorer households more?
It's a valid argument, but people are saying that it's $6 a month, that it's less than two cups of coffee at Starbucks, and that, I lost my train of thought, but basically it's $6 a month that would ultimately raise money that it's going to become more costly over time.
If you're just tuning in as we speak with the Times Union's Emily Block, we're looking at her report detailing the large backlog of deferred maintenance issues in the Duval County Public School buildings. The overriding issue is non-working air conditioning in a number of schools, nearly two dozen. But there were lots of other problems around the district. And as this is being reported, the Duval County School Board is lobbying the city council to approve putting a half-cent sales tax measure on the ballot in a special election for all of you, the voters, this November. The city council may vote, though, to defer this a year, given a number of considerations that they're looking at. And in the meantime, we're getting lots of calls about this. Let's go to Shelley in Fleming Island. Hi, Shelley.
Hi. I was just wondering in the report, or if anybody did any research on if all of the money that's been diverted to build really nice, shiny, sparkly new charter schools that the school board doesn't even own or have jurisdiction over, has that been one of the reasons why our budget shortfall has been so huge in repairing our aging or current infrastructure that we, you know, that we've been using all this time? Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call. You didn't research that for this particular piece, but what about her question?
It's a really good question, and I would love to have a more specific answer for you at a later point in time. I don't want to misspeak, but I do know that the work that we have looked into, the maintenance calls that we've looked into, is specifically for traditional public schools, not charter schools, which are also public schools. But these work orders particularly detail the work that's been done on public schools. So they're saying that AC systems cost a lot of money. In the meantime, they're just putting Band-Aids and repairing what they can.
Charter interests have lobbied publicly around town saying, look, we want a proportional splitting of funds for charter schools versus traditional public schools with this money. Here's an email from a listener. Please point out that a significant amount of charter schools in Duval are run by for-profit management companies that then rent their facilities to the charter. What other for-profit business that provides a service gets their building and maintenance upkeep paid for? The answer is none. What about that?
It's an interesting point again.
It's one that your newspaper has examined.
Yes, absolutely. So we've looked into charter schools versus public schools. A recent story I did looked into locations and where they are. And some school board members have argued that if they're in an area that has high performing students already, is the school performing well because of its innovation, or is it just drawing from the same pool of high performing students?
There are a number of charter schools around Duval County. We have a higher than average percentage. Some of them have done well, like the Kipp schools, for example.
Yes.
Have received mostly positive marks from parents and students. They've, you know, in terms of student achievement, they've improved somewhat on the public school in that district. At the same time, some other charter schools have not performed as well. Some have closed. And so, you know, shot through this whole argument, Emily, this whole public debate is the issue of how charters should be run, how they should be funded, what proportion of funds they should receive, taxpayer funds. Some taxpayers disagree with the curriculum that is taught in some charters, particularly creationist curriculum, but not only that. And so as you're writing about building maintenance issues, the more existential issue is how Florida has dealt with this issue.
Right. Absolutely.
That's the big picture issue.
Yes. Charter schools are here. They're not going away anytime soon, especially in Jacksonville and Duval County. The numbers have only been climbing up, and there's expansions and applications for new campuses constantly. But it boils down to that they are still public schools. So it's a matter of school choice. And what moms have been telling me is, well, if this referendum doesn't hit a ballot, what school choice really is there?
Okay.
How is that fair?
At the same time, as you write, the Jacksonville City Council will take this up tomorrow night. Let's set the stage for that. Let's push ahead to that tomorrow evening.
Yes. So tomorrow evening, the City Council is supposed to meet. There's no, currently, this could obviously change. There's no scheduled talks about the referendum tomorrow currently. For now, it looks like it's going to be pushed to July. But with today's morning meeting, there was a push for a meeting today to discuss it, though it doesn't look like that's going to happen. Things could change.
All right, Emily Block of the Times Union, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And up next, how one local man became a First Coast success story thanks to some lovable pound puppies. We'll be right back.
WGCT's podcast, What It's Like, tells the stories of local people.
I delivered a stillborn baby. The doctors always let you hold them, let you see them, and then they take them away and you never see them again.
Did you feel illegal?
You know, this word is tossed around so loosely.
I did. I kind of felt shame sometimes.
Take a listen to What It's Like wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us in celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, featuring Chasing the Moon events at WJCT and MOSH. Visit WJCT.org/events to explore what's coming your way. Take a drive with us into the blues horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT.
First Coast Success is brought to you by Iberia Bank.
We're pound puppies.
Cooler and the crew.
Whopper, Fried Eyes, Nose for me.
Helping Papa Rose.
Welcome back. Remember the pound puppies? They were one of the top-selling toys of the 80s. They even made it onto Time Magazine's all-time 100 greatest toys list. Well, guess what? They're getting a reboot, and Pound Puppies creator Mike Bowling lives right here in Northeast Florida. Karen Mathis of the Jax Daily Record speaks with Bowling about Pound Puppies and their reboot in this month's First Coast Success.
If you are a child of the 80s or bought toys for that age group, you probably are familiar with Pound Puppies, those droopy-eyed plush toys that became one of the all-time best-selling toys. The founder of Pound Puppies is Mike Bowling, who lives on Amelia Island. He is preparing for a relaunch of the puppies in September. Mike Bowling, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you. I appreciate the time here.
How did you come up with the idea of Pound Puppies?
You know, it was at Christmas time in 1983. I had bought a soft sculpture boy doll for my daughter for Christmas, and I was intrigued with how she loved it so much, took it everywhere, and I thought, well, you know, she considers that her baby. And I thought, well, if there's two things people love on this earth passionately, it's their kids and their pets, and some people treat their pets as if they're their kids. And when I was growing up, where did you go to get a pet? You went to the pound. And that was the start of the idea.
Well, how did you overcome the challenges in taking this idea and commercializing it, taking it to the market?
You know, the first thing that I did, which I didn't realize at the time, was the smartest thing that I did, and that was I went to an intellectual property attorney in Cincinnati, and I said, I've got this great idea. I want to create it, and I want to sell it to a toy company. And he said, you can't own an idea. You can own trademarks and copyrights and patents. And so I had to go about creating the product so I could file for the copyrights. At that time, you had to do shipments in interstate commerce to get your trademark registered. And so I went about the journey of starting to develop it and getting the copyrights and trademarks so I then could go meet with companies.
And so how did you go about meeting with companies?
You know, I was very fortunate in that when I started out developing the product line and networking with people and talking to different people, somebody recommended that I talk to a gentleman by the name of Bob Steiner out of Washington, D.C. His family had started the Kenner Toy Company, and he was currently a consultant in the toy industry. So I met with Bob and talked to him about representing me as it related to Pound Puppies, and he took the task on. He got me into all the major companies, but it still was a struggle because 14 people turned us down. Just because we got in with Bob didn't mean that they were going to take it. And so we just had to keep going and keep going until we found a company to take it.
And at what point did you know you had a hit on your hands?
You know, we first licensed it in Canada in 1984. We just found a Canadian company, Irwin, that took it first. And we immediately shot up to the number one new toy in Canada in 1984. We then licensed it to Tonka for 1985 launch, and we became the number one new toy in the U.S., and it was like a rocket ship.
Now, when are we going to see the Pound Puppies return?
Pound Puppies will be shipped into Target starting in August. So August, September, you see them on the shelf. And it's going to be an exclusive with Target this year. We're very excited about it. We went back to the original classic design, the classic box, because that's what people remember. You'll also be able to get it, of course, on Amazon. But our Target audience now will be a lot of mothers who were the kids that owned them when they were growing up. And the grandmothers of today were the mothers that bought them for their kids before. But also, don't forget the dads and the grandfathers who owned them as kids themselves. So hopefully we'll see a lot of people that will recognize the love and what goes with Pound Puppies and purchase those for their kids as well and grandchildren.
Well, Mike Bowling, creator of Pound Puppies, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Hey, and thank you for giving me the opportunity.
And in a moment, Women on Water, how a local company is teaching women to sail and empowering them through the sharing economy. We'll be right back.
JU and Mosh present Above and Beyond, a 90-second shortcast during Science Friday on 89.9 WJCT. Tune in for special Chasing the Moon segments starting now through July 12th.
Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup, where we talk about the biggest stories in the state.
From politics to education, the environment, and more. If it's news in Florida, we want to hear from you.
Let your voice be heard. Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Fridays at noon on WJCT.
Christina, what's on the front page of today's Times Union?
At the top of the page, Florida lawmakers may...
Around the country, volunteers are reading local newspapers to people with vision loss or print disabilities. Did you know WJCT has this service? On a special radio we provide, you'll get the Florida Times Union every day. Learn more at wjct.org/radio reading. With help from sponsors like Florida Eye Specialists, radio reading gives voice to the printed word.
Welcome back. Well, she's a local business owner helping other women take the helm in their own lives. Roseanne Points overcame a patriarchal upbringing and an abusive marriage and created a new company. It's called Sail Time Northeast Florida. It empowers other women through the sharing economy, and she's doing it on the water. Roseanne Points, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Let's offer congratulations. First of all, you're celebrating your one-year anniversary as the owner of Sail Time Northeast Florida. How does the company work?
Oh, thank you, first of all. So Sail Time is a sharing economy similar to a sailing club where individuals can come be a member on a sailboat and go sailing without the cost of owning their own boat, the cost of maintenance. We take care of all of those things.
Right. You get the experience without the hassle of boat ownership.
Exactly.
Best of both worlds. Now, you've come a long way from your childhood with becoming the CEO of a company. How were you raised?
Well, my dad's from Portugal, And so he was very traditional, women in the house, men work in the fields. And so when I was born, I was very much a women liber kind of thing, as you might want to think. So I wanted to do it all. But he really said, nope, Roseanne, this is how your life is going to be, and get used to it. So I pretty much bedded that the whole way.
You left home at 16.
I did.
Because you didn't agree with that vision for your life.
Correct. Yes. I wanted to make my own future.
And you did that. But first you had some other bumps along the way, an abusive marriage. And then in your second marriage, you ended up, I guess, on the water. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. He came home and he said, we're going to sell everything we own. Buy a boat and travel the world.
How did you react to that?
It was a little stunning because it wasn't exactly my vision of what I wanted in my life. But I was dedicated and wanted to make our marriage work. So I left and we took our three kids and moved aboard a 41-foot Morgan Out Island Ketch and started sailing.
And you traveled the world in that boat?
No, just the Caribbean pretty much. We left. I didn't know anything about sailing. We homeschooled our kids.
On the boat.
Well, I did. Yeah.
You did.
Yeah.
And you did a good job with that.
Well, I don't think I did, but my kids think I did. So
but they, I mean, okay. they excelled academically.
They did.
It's hard enough to homeschool kids, and you did it on a boat. That's pretty impressive.
Well, it was... It's kind of easier when there's not a lot of distractions, and living on a boat really makes your life simple and really bonds a family together, I think.
So how did you go from sailing around the Caribbean with your husband and kids to creating Sail Time?
Well, after my second marriage ended, I spent quite a bit of time by myself, and then I met my current husband, Chuck, who was very supportive. And when I left my job that I had, the boat brokerage kind of was something that I had known about. Boats was something that I was very familiar with after 13 years of living aboard. And so we thought this was something that we could do together because he is an avid sailor himself.
And here you are. How does Sail Time work? Besides going out and sort of renting a sailboat, mm-hmm. What else does the company do?
Well, through St. Augustine Sailing, we do sailing charters by the hour or by the day. We have vessels ranging from 21 feet up to 45 feet, both monohulls and catamarans. And we're also an affiliate ASA sailing school, so we teach people how to sail from basic keelboat sailing, coastal cruising, bareboat, chartering, coastal navigation, as well as the Sail Time piece of it, where you can come and be a part of the membership and take your own vessel and take the vessel and be your own skipper.
You also recently launched WOW, Women on Water, and this is women teaching other women how to sail.
Exactly.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so we have a couple of other female captain and instructors. And so we host weekly workshops, as you might say, for a couple of hours, ranging from splicing or navigation, how to do dead reckoning, how to do set and drift, or even just simple things, knot tying, different parts of the boat, points of sail, all different things, just to help people help the women get more comfortable being a sailor themselves, to be comfortable on board, and to give the commands themselves.
And how do you see that impacting the women that step onto your boats and learn this?
Well, from what I've experienced thus far, because it's fairly new, all the women that I've dealt with so far have been very excited and have enjoyed it very much.
It's empowering.
Very much so. It's kind of exciting and thrilling to be able to be behind the helm and handle a 40-foot boat by yourself and be able to give commands to other people of how to get the boat to turn
yeah,
and to move forward.
Did your father live long enough to see you become the CEO of a company and drive the boat literally and figuratively in life?
Yes, he is still alive, and I'm happy to say he's very proud of me.
That's good. So he's come around, I guess, on how he sees your role in life.
Yeah. I mean, some 50 years later.
It took a while.
Being in America, you can't help but to get Americanized. But yeah, he very much is a huge supporter. And I feel is very proud of me. And I've actually been able to take him out on the boat. And he gets excited when he sees that I'm happy.
Your journey, especially the image of the sailboat, is such a beautiful metaphor for how you blossomed and took command. What do you love about sailing?
Well, for me, it's just the simple part of it, being out in the open water, and the engines turned off, and then everything that happens is because of you, how you manage the boat, how you handle the boat. Is all because of how the decisions that you make and how you proceed. So you can go slow or you can go fast. It's up to you.
You're harnessing the wind, and it can be exhilarating and scary all at the same time.
Oh yeah, it definitely can be. Yeah.
I love sailing, but I'm always a little scared of it, especially after I watched the movie Dead Calm. There's something about being out on the water on a sailboat that is, you're right, you're on a knife's edge. If something goes wrong, things can get a little ugly. So how do you maintain safety and keep the people on your boats feeling good about their experience and not being frightened?
Yeah, so I mean, that's part of what we do at WOW, as well as is helping women to know how to troubleshoot, how to, when you're out there, because the only thing that you have is yourself. And so being able to have the knowledge of knowing what the situation is and how to troubleshoot what's happening and knowing how to fix it really alleviates some of that fear. And for me as a woman, I get afraid, but then the inner part of you is the strength of, I can do this, you know, so you remain calm and think through the solution and get whatever needs to be done. And so in the classes through our ASA, through the WOW program, and even through just our regular charters, we always do safety is the most important. We educate anybody that's on the boat of what needs to be done if something happens.
If you want to learn to sail, especially if you're a woman, but not just if you're a woman, you need to check out Sail Time Northeast Florida. They are in St. Augustine on Harbor Drive, and Roseanne Points is the skipper in more ways than one. So it's such a pleasure to meet you, and kudos on all your success.
Oh, thank you so much, Melissa.
And in a moment, Culpepper on a banner week for U.S. soccer. We'll be right back.
Social media has created new ways to connect and to sell things. Take micro-influencers, regular people paid to hype products on sites like Instagram.
We have this unique opportunity that I don't think anyone has ever had before, where we can each be our own brand.
Entrepreneurial frontier or capitalist dystopia? That story and the latest on tensions between the U.S. and Iran this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world. In the new book, At the Dawn of Tourism in Florida, John T. Foster says that abolitionists, including Harriet Beecher Stowe, started Florida's tourism industry. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with John Foster. We'll discuss Florida's Audubon Society and writer Zora Neale Hurston. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, life after leaving a religion. Terry talks with Amber Scora, a third-generation Jehovah's Witness who was raised to believe that Armageddon was imminent. Her decision to leave her faith left her without family, friends, or a support system. Now considered an apostate, she started a new life. Her memoir is called Leaving the Witness. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
High in the Colorado Mountains, leaders from around the world gather every summer to tackle the biggest issues shaping our lives and challenging our times. The Aspen Ideas Festival brings together America's best thinkers, writers, businessmen, and women. We'll spend time talking with them and sharing a range of key debates. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it has been a banner week for both the U.S. men's and women's national soccer teams.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper's here now with more. Let's start with the women. They are just on fire.
Yeah, they've been fantastic, and they face the Spanish national team today at noon in the knockout round of the Women's World Cup. The U.S. women's team rolled through the group stage virtually unchallenged. They set a record in a 13-0 win over Thailand, then didn't allow a shot on target from Chile. Then they dispatched Sweden in the final match in the group. Now they move on to the knockout round where they will face Spain, a team they beat 1-0 in January. Interestingly, that is the only time the U.S. and Spain have ever met in women's soccer in history. Again, that match kicks off at noon Eastern time. The U.S. continues to be the odds-on favorite to win their fourth Women's World Cup. The men's team, meanwhile, enjoying their Gold Cup match last night in a two nights ago in a 6-0 thumping of Trinidad and Tobago. Josh Yzardis and Aaron Longboat scored a pair. Christian Pulisic assisted on two and scored another as the U.S. qualified for the knockout round of the Gold Cup. And the Gold Cup, by the way, is the biggest tournament the U.S. will play before the World Cup in 2022. So this has been a good week for U.S. soccer, and locally, it's been a good week for soccer as well. The Armada, that is fielding a U-23 team, has qualified for the NPSL playoffs. We haven't talked about the Armada very much this year. Frankly, the club has not been seeking that much attention. They're playing with a team of college players, not pros like they have in the past. They're kind of in a holding pattern, waiting for some clarity on a couple of issues, including which league to join next year and whether they'll have a stadium. This year, they're playing at Patton Park as they look for land to purchase to build a soccer-specific stadium in the future.
You always have this, over the years, people have had the stereotype that U.S. sports fans just don't care about soccer. Is that changing now with the men's and women's soccer doing so well on the global stage?
Well, I'll point to the U.S. missing the World Cup, the men's team missing the World Cup last time out. There was more outrage, disgust, and disappointment for the U.S. missing the World Cup than you would see in a situation where you don't have people care. If you don't care, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But there was a little bit of outrage there. So I think soccer continues to grow in terms of popularity. The TV ratings certainly would indicate that, as would attendance. And when you look at what's happening, say, for instance, in Atlanta, where the Atlanta MLS team is packing the Falcon Stadium just about every time they play. You see what's happened in Seattle and some other places. It's not going to catch up to the National Football League by any stretch of the imagination, but I think the perception of where soccer is right now and the value that people are putting on it is certainly far ahead of where it was, say, 10 years ago.
Yeah, come a long way. All right, let's talk about Mike Martin, the FSU head coach. Cole says can now begin his retirement.
Yep, the FSU coach saw his 40th and final season come to an end with a loss to Texas Tech in the College World Series. Martin will certainly be remembered for his 2,000-plus wins and his 17 College World Series appearances and for taking the Noles to the postseason in every single one of his 40 seasons and for the players who played for him, guys like Deion Sanders, J.D. Drew, Buster Posey, and more. But more than anything, he's going to be remembered for the way that other people have seen him. And I've known a lot of people in college baseball through the years. I don't know a single person, talking coach, writer, player, broadcaster, who has a bad thing to say about Mike Martin. He's exactly the kind of coach that every athletic director should be looking to hire for any position. He's highly successful, highly respected, and highly loyal. And now he can watch his son, Mike Martin Jr., carry on his legacy. Jr. was named as the next head coach of the Seminoles.
Sad, though, that he ended on a loss. I know you were hoping he'd have a win.
Yeah, I think it certainly is finishing on a high note, because when you make the College World Series, that's a big deal. Final eight teams in college baseball. And this was not a team that was likely going to make a run all the way, but he got him further than anybody expected. Would have been an amazing story if he would have finished out his career with his first and only College World Series championship.
Okay, two more news and notes. Both the Sharks and the Shrimp playing through this hot summer. People can check them out at a bunch of upcoming games.
Yeah, Sharks in the air conditioning set a franchise record by scoring 83 points with a win over New York this past weekend. Jacksonville's now 8-1. They've won eight straight games. They lost the first game of the year to New York and then haven't lost since. They'll have the rubber match against New York in Gotham coming up this week before they return home after that. And the Shrimp will conclude their first series after the All-Star break with a game tonight against Pensacola at the baseball grounds.
And the Shrimp and the Sharks doing a great job making the fan experience a really fun night out for the family.
Yeah, yesterday in some hot conditions, it was a Sunday fun day for the family. It's always great to see after the games the kids running the bases and seeing how all the kids really engage with what's going on there, getting autographs from the players and so forth. Of course, the Sharks always put on a great show at the arena. And this year, with the way things have gone, we didn't know at the beginning of the season, quite frankly, you know, the loss to New York was the first game that New York had ever played. And you thought, oh boy, this might be a long season, but the Sharks have really gotten it together since then and have reeled off eight straight wins, which certainly helps the atmosphere when you're winning.
Good for them. You can always follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Catch him every night on the news, giving you the sports. It's our news partner, Channel 4, the local station. And every Monday on this program, always good to see you.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. We always value your feedback. Send those emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, a look at alcohol-free alternatives here on the First Coast. When it comes to going out, we'll explain. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.